Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm excited about this week's episode because we're going to get under the hood a little bit. We're going to go behind the scenes and see a little bit about how some things that we talk about every year are figured out. And we're going to look at that and look at the hurricane forecast behind the scenes. And I'm really excited about that. So we'll get to that in just a second. Before we can do any of that, though, we have to bring in my co-host, Sam Bradley, who has like jumped through hoops, done everything she had to do to get here today. And here she is. Finally, we got the audio working. Sam, how are you?
Oh, my God. This has been a tech nightmare tonight. I don't know what's going on, but I think we're good now.
I think so.
And we have Dan and Becky, so it doesn't get better than that. Since we're talking about the weather in particular. And Becky did an awesome job last week when we first looked at hurricane season coming up. But now we got Dan, too, so we can dig into that a little deeper. But first, there's all kinds of other stuff going on in the country. We had the earthquake in Taiwan, which is the worst they've had in 25 years, a 7.4. We're going to have to get Zahner on here because all these buildings are kind of leaning over like the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
But they didn't collapse. I mean, that's the thing that I immediately thought of was they're leaning like at a 45-degree angle, but they didn't collapse. So people were able to get out of the building.
Well, that's good. But now what?
Well,
Becky, you have a thought on that.
Well, so this is the worst earthquake in quite some time, but they had another pretty major earthquake, I think, in the late 90s. And following that earthquake, they made significant changes to their building codes, which is why, you know, come this earthquake, they didn't just completely fully collapse. I think from what I saw, they were the one that was like crazy and leaning and had like the glass facade. They were still doing active rescues from that building, which you wouldn't have seen, you know, 2 decades ago. The building would have been just rubble.
Yeah, it's like, well, you can't just get a really big board and bolster it up. What are they going to do with this leaning building? Well, I guess we're a little off topic here. Anyway, so in the rest of our country, there's California is having something about the AccuWeather said, a real cold rain snap going on. We're having red flag warnings and everyone's using their air conditioner. Here in Colorado, thunderstorms in the plains. And Jamie, all of you guys, you're getting some.
I've got the initial keel laid for my ark. And so I'm on a good roll now that I hope to have it done in time for all of this rain to not come up to my driveway. So that's where we are.
Well, see, that answers my question on what's going on in the East Coast. And then in the Kentucky, Oklahoma area, they're having tornadoes. Dan, you want to explain yourself?
I'll do my best.
Your AccuWeather that I'm getting this off of. So
yeah, it's been a very, very busy last, I would say, week and a half with all those things you mentioned, Sam. In the last couple of days, we've had, you know, it's spring, so we do expect severe thunderstorms, and there's this time of year where you get more flooding events. But there's been a lot of different things across different parts of the country with the tornadoes and a few in Oklahoma to start the month on Monday, and then a few in Illinois and Indiana, and then into Ohio on Tuesday. There was a bunch of semis, the tractors flipped on some highway near Louisville on, I think it was Tuesday, hard to keep track of days at this point. But so that it was a pretty impressive severe weather stretch there Monday, Tuesday, especially here as we started the month of April. And then to the east of that, where there wasn't a lot of severe thunderstorms, there was significant flooding. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania had their worst flood in probably about 10 years or so. Nowhere near some of their records, but significant flooding along the Ohio and the other rivers in that area. And as Jamie mentioned, it's been really wet too, even in places where they haven't had flooding. March was the wettest March on record in a number of locations in the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast. And April is off to the wettest start in on record in many of those same spots. So it's been a very wet stretch for the Northeastern United States. And that even dates back to the fall where it was wet for a fair amount of time as well. So the Northeast Mid-Atlantic's been pretty wet for the last 6 months or so. And there's a lot of other interesting weather elsewhere, as you mentioned, with cold in California, dry and windy with some fire risk in the plains. And it's spring. So spring usually yields a lot of different types of weather. And that's certainly what we're seeing right now.
Well, that's what caught my attention. I mean, it's so completely diverse. And, you know, you'd expect it to be warmer in California and cooler in Colorado, and it's the opposite. So y'all come down here because it's warm and it's not raining, at least today. So, well, what does this next week look like, Dan, before we jump into our topic?
Well, the first thing that will end, which I failed to mention, is the major snowstorm. The second in the course of a week or so in the Northeast, or like in the interior Northeast New England, that's going to come to an end Friday, but that's going to bring another 2 feet of snow or more to the mountains. They already picked up 2 to 3 feet last week. So a really impressive string of late season snow in northern New England. Good for the ski resorts. But in terms of the next week, well, I mean, the big news from not a weather standpoint, but an astronomical standpoint, is the eclipse on Monday afternoon, the 8th of April. And obviously the weather does play a role in that, because if it's cloudy, it doesn't really give you as good of a showing, especially in the path of totality that goes from Texas up to New England. That looks like it's going to be cloudy in a lot of spots, especially Arkansas, Kentucky, Indiana. That area looks like it's going to be pretty cloudy, not good viewing conditions for the eclipse. So that's a story on Monday. But in terms of the weather, I think it's overall a quieter week next week. There's some severe thunderstorm risk on Saturday in just a couple of days here in the middle of the country, but not as bad as we saw the last few days. And overall, I think next week is generally quieter, but with the exception probably being the southern plains like Oklahoma, Texas, Louisiana, with a couple of rounds of heavy rain and thunderstorms in that area during the middle of the week. So, but staying wet in the east, still more rain, probably a dry start of the week in the Northeast, but then rain chances return later in the week.
Put a little more wood on that arc there, Jamie. We're not done yet.
yep. I'm working on it. I'm using shiplap, so like the old Viking ships. So hopefully that'll make it a little more flexible. But
perfect. Any thoughts from you, Becky?
Turn around,
she's
don't
in the
drown.
Kitchen looking for food.
Yeah. No, I just say turn around, don't drown. I mean, it's a good time for a reminder to not drive through flooded roadways. Not fully related to flooding, but parts of the Big Sur Highway in California, that road is crumbling and is going to probably be closed permanently here in the not too distant future because of erosion. So it's just if the road's flooded and you cannot see the road, don't drive, because you don't know if there's a road still there.
Good point. Well, where there's erosion, there's mudslides. I'm sure they're already getting some of that in California. So one thing after another. I think there was another thought I had, but now I forgot what it was. In any case, if it's milder next week, then a lot of people will be happy. But no, I know what I was thinking. Maybe it's time to do not just hurricanes, but, you know, there's so many different kinds of preparedness if you look at this week alone, because everybody had something different. And tornado season, you got that going on. We haven't talked about that much. So it's like wherever you happen to be, know what's going on and figure out how to manage it. Becky?
So it's speaking of a lot of things going on, I think something that's sort of somewhat flown under the radar is the fact that there's a total eclipse happening. And anywhere along the path, those small towns, rural areas need to be prepared for a massive influx of people. And emergency managers, you know, of those counties and those jurisdictions need to be prepared for a lot more people than they're used to having, you know, what, and it's anything from like, you know, making sure you have enough police on staff to manage crowds and traffic to ambulance, to if there might be, you know, more traffic accidents because people are distracted. I mean, to even things like restaurants, making sure they're going to be fully stocked for a significant increase in people. And I think hopefully there were a lot of lessons learned from the 2017 eclipse in, you know, how to be prepared. I don't even know how many more people than you would normally have coming through these areas.
Oh, that's a really good point. And they're all going to get down there and not be able to see it because it's cloudy or something else is going on. You know, I got to tell you, that's kind of a fascinating thing. But to go through all of that to see it, I don't know.
Wow, it's worth it. It's worth it.
I've not seen one.
The whole totality is worth it.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to it. We're going to be like in the 80% zone, and I've got my I've got my eclipse glasses and everything ready to go. So,
can you get some eclipse pictures?
I'll see. I'll see what I can do. But it's
those of us.
You know, I know Niagara, the Niagara region of Ontario, Canada, declared a state of emergency pending the eclipse, because it is going to be a zone of totality over that region, and they are expecting an influx of people. And they did that so that they can free up resource money for them to put on additional overtime hours for police officers and other first responders to be available to handle the influx of crowds, just like Becky said.
Yeah, well, Becky just said smart. Becky, do you know if any of the aforementioned areas in our country are doing anything like that? Do you know? Or
are we no, just I mean, hoping? I haven't looked specifically at the whole path. I do know that there's expected severe weather in parts of Texas that overlaps. Stan's shaking his head. So after the eclipse. Well, yeah, but you might have an intersection of people trying to chase and people driving to see the eclipse. So anyway, I mean, no, that's a good point, Jamie. I hope other counties and areas have done the same.
Well, we may end up with an eclipse episode next week, depending on what happens. But in the meantime, Jamie, why don't you address the question of the day to Dan and let him run with it.
Well, you know, we talked about the hurricane forecast briefly last week and kind of touched on it. Becky did a great job of helping us lead into that topic for this week. And one of the things I thought it would be great to do is to really dig into exactly what goes into making that kind of a long-range forecast. I mean, we're basically forecasting out 6-7 months into the future. So I was curious, and I think maybe a lot of you out there in podcast land might be curious, of what goes into that forecast and what is the level of reliability that they predict for that kind of long forecast going out that far into the distance and saying this is what we expect over the coming season. So Dan, why don't you kind of just give us an idea of, like, at AccuWeather or other forecast centers, what goes into pulling all that data together?
Yeah, Jamie. So it's a different type of forecast process than what you see, like if you watch your local TV network in your local news, or you get information on your app for the next day or the day after. It's a very different process for forecasting a hurricane season versus forecasting for tomorrow and whether it's going to rain or not. So sort of a couple things that come to mind and how we approach it. And this is, I think it's pretty standard across the board. AccuWeather produces a seasonal hurricane forecast today. The Colorado State University just issued theirs. They've been doing it for a long period of time. And there's many others. National Hurricanes, or NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, sends out a forecast in May. And there's a number of other ones that do similar things. And they all use sort of similar techniques. But we sort of start with what we know about tropical systems. And we'll talk only about the Atlantic Basin for purposes of this podcast. So yeah, we talk about Atlantic hurricanes for the purposes of this discussion. And so we start with what we know about how hurricanes or tropical systems form. And we know that generally hurricanes and tropical systems need warm water. And the warmer the water, generally that's better fuel for the storms to form. You need a lack of wind shear, and wind shear is basically defined as changing wind speed and direction with height in the atmosphere. So you want low wind shear, because high wind shear tends to rip apart storms as they try to form. You don't want dry air. Sometimes you get dust that comes off of Africa during the season, which can add to the, it can create drier air across the Atlantic Basin, which can inhibit tropical system formation. And then there's a number of other different factors, but those are sort of the primary factors in terms of what we look at. And then there's different types of weather patterns that impact those factors. Obviously, we look at what the water temperatures are across parts of the Atlantic Basin, especially the part where a lot of the storms form, which is called the main development region, which is from the east, west coast of Africa across the basically just north of the equator through the Lesser Antilles there in the Caribbean, that area. So we look at that area in terms of the water temperatures and different factors like El Nino or La Nina, which drive wind shear across the Atlantic Basin as well. So all these sort of things are interconnected. And we know from past seasons how, in certain situations, it's impacted the number of storms in the Atlantic Basin season. So we sort of start there with all of that together and then look at the different forecast models and models of sea surface temperature and models of El Nino and La Nina and sort of see, what is the prediction there and then turn that into actual numbers of tropical systems, numbers of hurricanes, and what risks there are to the U.S. So that's a very general overview, and then we can go into some more depth from there.
Okay, well, Becky switched apparatus here, and she's back. Did you have a comment on what Dan's talking about so far?
I mean, it's just, I would say it's a very, there's a lot of factors that go into it. And I think there can sometimes be some skepticism about some of these longer range forecasts and, people thinking that it's just numbers being made up when actually there's a great deal of skill and very knowledgeable forecasters looking at the best data they can at the time to come up with some type of outlook. And obviously, as you get closer to the season beginning, more factors come into play and the picture becomes clearer. And obviously, unfortunately, all of the, typical purveyors of hurricane outlooks are calling for a very severe hurricane season. And so I really hope that people are starting to take this very seriously and getting preparations in order.
Yeah, and that's kind of what we were talking about last week when we had you on with us. And that's just kind of scary. But how many of those factors you mentioned, Dan, go into this particular season they're concerned with? And where does the jet stream come in? I know that's a factor too, isn't it?
Yeah, so to answer the first question, most of the factors that we talk about in terms of being favorable for a lot of tropical systems are sort of aligned that way. We have the warmest sea surface temperatures on record in the Atlantic Basin for this time of year, and it's not close. And even if they were to, and this is the time of year where they're typically on the quote-unquote cooler side, they warm up and peak in September. Usually that's the warmest water temperatures of the year. So it's good. We know the water temperatures are going to be on the warmer side. Whether they're record or not, they're still going to be warmer than average. We are in an El Nino now, which is warmer than normal water in the Pacific Ocean, and that influences weather patterns and winds in the atmosphere across the Atlantic Ocean. But that El Nino will change to a La Nina. That's the forecast, and we're pretty confident in that in the spring here into the summer. And during a La Nina, you typically have less wind shear. And we were saying that less wind shear is good for tropical system development. It's favorable for development of tropical systems. So that those two together are big reasons why the forecasts so far that have been out from AccuWeather and Colorado State are really on the high end of the forecast for the seasons. And then you asked about the jet stream. The jet stream doesn't necessarily impact the way in which storms form because most of the storms swarm well south of where the jet stream lies because they form in the tropics, which is not really influenced by the jet stream. But the jet stream is very important in terms of how storms track as they gain latitude. So as they move north, the jet stream is that ribbon of air sort of wind sort of at the level that planes fly, and it generally moves from west to east across the United States and is part of the reason that storms tend to quote-unquote recurve or turn off to the east as they gain latitude and move north. That's why a lot of the storms in the Atlantic Basin, you see a lot every year that form the Atlantic Basin. They get sort of close to Bermuda or western Bermuda, and then they miss the U.S. and they go and they turn northeast and go out to sea, or they go into Canada. That's one of the reasons is the jet stream. And also one of the reasons is where there's usually an area of high pressure that's located near Bermuda. And that area of high pressure sort of steers those storms to the west of that high and then up to the north up towards Canada or out into the open Atlantic. So we look at the location of that high and what we think that area of high, where we think that area of high pressure is going to be located during a season, if it's going to be located farther east or farther west. And that helps us to determine where we think the sort of the more likely path for storms is during a hurricane season.
Well, let's hope Jamie gets his arc done before all of that comes up. Well, one of the other things we touched on last week was the fact that these storms, when they hit, say, you know, somewhere in the south, be it Louisiana or Florida, they go up so far. The flooding goes up so far and over a longer period, it seems like. What was that storm last year, Dan, that went on for like a week, just kept going and going and going? Jamie, you know which one I'm talking about.
I'm not sure I do. You want to, which this past year?
These all blend together. The main impact from last year was Idalia. Idalia made landfall on the Gulf Coast last year in Florida. I forget exactly the inland issues with that. One of the big ones from 2021 was Ida. They always seem to be the eye storms. And that actually is a thing. The eye storms seem to be significantly impactful, which is interesting, but it's probably because they happen during the peak of the season, which is when they're usually the worst. But anyway, Ida made landfall in Louisiana in 2021 and brought significant flooding to not just where it made landfall, but then major, unfortunately, I think it brought fatalities to New York City with just really, really bad flooding as the moisture from Ida moved northward in September of 2021.
Yeah, it might have been Ida, because I remember it went north and then went east, and so it went like all the way up the eastern seaboard. It's like, this is weird. I don't remember them doing that, but maybe I just wasn't paying enough attention. Jamie, you have more questions for Dan on?
Well, no, I one of the things, I mean, Dan actually sent us some information, Colorado State University, and how much it agrees with the AccuWeather forecast, that the two different forecast centers have come up with basically similar numbers and looking at the same data. And I think that that's, you know, at least a reason for pause, because, you know, if we're going to have 4 to 6 direct U.S. impacts from up to, you know, 12 to 15 hurricanes, maybe of those 4 to 7 major hurricanes, you know, and that the water temperature's already at record highs for this time of year. What is that? You know, we always talk about the water temperature feeding the hurricane, and I guess that's part of the reason that the forecast is so strong.
Yeah, that's definitely a significant reason why the forecasts are on the higher end. From an AccuWeather standpoint, we're forecasting 20 to 25 named storms, which is tropical storms and hurricanes. And we believe that's the highest forecast we've ever put out. And I know in reading the Colorado State forecast, that's also the highest forecast. They're forecasting 23. I think they have a range somewhere in their discussion, but the number they have out in the headline is 23 named storms, so right aligned with what we have from AccuWeather. And that's the highest initial April forecast they've ever issued for a season. The historical average over the last 30 years is 14 named storms. So we're talking about, you know, somewhere between like 8 to 10 more than the historical average. Last year we had 19, which was a very active season. Obviously, you know, there's many years where it's active and a lot of them don't hit the U.S. The challenge we have this year is we feel like, you know, one of the things we look at is the searing winds and where we think storms will go when they form. We are concerned this year that the pattern is going to set up in a way that there is a higher than average risk to the U.S. Colorado State forecast has stated that as well. I think they have a 60%, 62% landfall risk for the entire U.S. coast, which is the average is 43% in any given year. So that's about 20% higher than average. So that's certainly noteworthy. I know from our AccuWeather forecast, we're most concerned with the Texas coastline, as well as the Florida Panhandle, and then also South Florida and the Carolinas. And that's a lot of areas, obviously, but we look at other years that are similar and determine, like, okay, how did those years, like, what happened in those years? And from a Texas standpoint, There's been a few systems in the last couple of years, but there's not been a major hurricane category 3 or higher hit in Texas since 2017 with Harvey, which is obviously a devastating storm from a flooding standpoint in Houston. But that's been 7 years. So there's a lot more building that's gone on, a lot of people that may have moved there that don't haven't had experience with a tropical system. So there's a lot of risk, and there's a lot of places that have not been hit recently. South Florida is one of them. Miami is a hugely vulnerable area. They have not had a major landfalling system since Andrew, and Andrew went south of them really in 92. That wasn't a worst case scenario. It's really been about 100 years, I think, since the last really significant storm in 1926 made landfall in Miami.
And Becky, that kind of brings us around to the preparedness angle of things, which is, you know, what is the messaging look like for people that, you know, haven't experienced a major hurricane and maybe even in their lifetime, even though they're in a hurricane prone area, doesn't necessarily mean that they've had more than rain and some wind and not had a direct impact. So how do you message that in a way that lets them understand the risk?
I mean, it's a great question, Jamie. I think it's incredibly challenging. And we know from past experience that people find it hard to fully grasp the severity of a situation unless they've gone through it before. You have Irene, and then Sandy happened a year later, and people took Sandy much more seriously because they had gone through Irene on places like the Jersey Shore. They also took it less seriously in other places because Irene wasn't as bad, which is another problem. But as far as the messaging, I think trying to conceptualize the impacts as much as possible. So, you know, saying there's going to be record flooding. Okay, well, how high is the water actually going to come? Can you put a visual on that? Can you say, you know, that I think some of the wording that like the National Hurricane Center will use at times is very impactful. You know, when you use words like catastrophic. Okay, that should trigger something for people. But I mean, really the most important thing that people can do to be as in tune and as possible for hurricane season is know who your local officials are. Where are you going to be getting this information? You know, who are the sources that you can trust that are going to be telling you the weather information? And then when it comes to whether or not you're going to need to evacuate, you have to understand where to get that information. You have to understand what county you're in. You have to understand the routes out that you will take and know where you're going to go. And all of that really should be determined well ahead of time, because you don't want to be trying to make those decisions in the heat of the moment when you're stressed and there's a hurricane bearing down on you. And you have, you know, a matter of 12 hours to board up your house and evacuate. I don't know that I've fully answered your question, but I kind of went off on a tangent. Understand your local, where to get information for your local area.
And that's important, because the messaging is, lately, I've looked at what they've done in recent years in places like Florida when they had the impacts on the Gulf Coast in the past couple of years from a couple of major storms. And they were predicting those impacts somewhere along that coastline, and they were correct. It landed somewhere along that coastline. It may not have landed exactly where they thought it was 3 or 4 days ahead of time, but they still issued evacuation orders for the people right on the coast and along that whole stretch. And I think that what you said about doing that preparation and planning early, part of that planning is, when are you going to pull the trigger on evacuating? And, you know, my answer would be, if you get an evacuation order, as soon as you get it, you should be thinking that it's time to leave. And that may be 2 to 3 days ahead of time, and you have enough time to get far enough inland or make plans or do something ahead of time. But don't wait until it's 6 hours away and the roads are backed up and the gas stations are closing and all of those things that cascade events that happen as the storm starts narrowing down its cone of probability. I think that's what I would say to that, Beck.
Well, that, and you know what's going to come. You know you're going to be likely getting bad storms or hurricanes. So have your kit ready to go. Don't be doing all that at the last minute, like you were saying, Jamie. You know, get your affairs in order. Have all the things you need to take in a bag, so if you have to grab and run, you can. You can do a lot of that ahead of time. You can do a lot of that today. you know, especially if you're in a hurricane prone region. The more you get prepared now, the less you'll have to worry about it when it's hitting the fan. And I think that's a good way to wrap it, Jamie. Becky did it beautifully. So it wasn't just about how the weather gets there, but what are you going to do when it does?
Absolutely. And I want to thank Joe couldn't be here tonight. He had a family commitment, but I want to just always thank Joe and Paragon Medical Education Group for their sponsorship of the show. One of the things that they do a really good job of is talking about provider preparedness and responder preparedness in the event that an impact happens in your region, so that you're prepared for your family's safety and then can go on to do the training and things you need to do so that you can do the rescues that are inevitable in those situations as well. So check them out at paragonmedicalgroup.com. And of course, there are links over in the disasterpodcast.com page as well to get to them. Ask them to customize an experience for the disasters and emergencies that happen in your region. Becky, where can folks find out what you're talking about?
I'd say the Disaster Podcast Facebook group. Always have to answer any questions. And over on Blue Sky at WXBEX.
Awesome. Dan?
Disaster Podcast Facebook group. On Twitter at WX Depot. And then one other thing I just wanted to note here on this topic, these types of numbers, obviously, I think it can be somewhat scary if you live in a coastal or prone location for hurricanes, because it's obviously predicting a very significant season here. But it's, you know, certainly not a time to panic. We're still well in advance of the season. So plenty of time to think about what to do if a hurricane is coming towards your location and what actions you will take. Certainly time to prepare and to think about those types of plans.
Definitely. Good advice there, Dan. Thank you. Sam, where can people find you?
Well, in all those places. I haven't tried Blue Sky yet. I'll have to check that out. But under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. How about you, Jamie?
People can find me under the handle PodMedic in a lot of social media locations out there. So I definitely urge you to look me up. And of course, in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group, we continue to grow. We're just under 1,000 members over there. So if you have a friend or somebody that's in the response community or interested in disaster preparedness, definitely hook them up with us and we'll get them into the community there. And just want to remind you that you can subscribe to the show. There's links to do that right over at disasterpodcast.com. Sam, I'm glad we were able to pull this episode together tonight, and we'll have more to come as the hurricane season starts to wind up. We might even have, who knows, we might even get a storm before the official start date, because as we know, the weather doesn't care about our calendar.
Yeah, I think it even said that somewhere, that be prepared for it. Disaster knows no bounds or no calendars. It's just the way it is. But I think the general message tonight is think ahead, plan ahead, and be prepared.